Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Nishant, and welcome to another episode of the Nishant Garg Show. This show is for people who want to live a fulfilled life through mindfulness practices, psychology, and personal transformation. My job on this show is to invite world-class performers to share the practices to live a fulfilled life. This episode guest is Dr. John Shinerer. Dr. John coaches clients to perform at their peak from the boardroom to the bedroom. Dr. John graduated from UC Berkeley with a PhD in educational psychology. Dr. John was one of three experts to consult with Pixar on the Academy Award-winning movie Inside Out. He has spoken to organizations such as Stanford Medical School, UC Berkeley, Yahoo, AT&T, and The Gap. He has been featured in national media such as US News and World Report, Reader's Digest, and Self Magazine. He is a nationally recognized speaker and an award-winning author. He wrote the award-winning book, How Can I Be Happy? His areas of expertise range from high performance to stress management to positive psychology to anger management to creating happy, thriving relationships. Over 10,000 people have taken his online anger management course. He recently recorded micro courses on anger management and forgiveness for Simple Habit. They have been listened to nearly 100,000 times in the first year. Dr. John hosts a podcast to help men evolve towards greater success, happiness, and connection. The Evolve K-Men. Visit guidetoself.com to learn more about Dr. John or follow on Instagram at The Evolve K-Men. And now let the episode begin. Dr. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Nishant.
My pleasure. And I would love to start off this conversation by asking you, how would your family describe what you do for a living?
Oh, that's a tough one. I'm still struggling with that, but I think the simplest explanation is executive coach, but I also think of myself as simply a teacher. You know, I've gathered tools to help people turn down the volume on the negative and turn up the volume on the positive. And so I just kind of go through life teaching tools and skills to people that are interested in learning them.
Teacher of what?
A teacher of psychology, how to master the mind and the heart. And mostly I teach men because I think men are deeply in need of these tools. And that's partly because of the way that we're socialized in the man box culture.
And what is man box culture for our listeners?
The man box culture is when we're growing up as boys and this starts really young. It starts pre-kindergarten, so the age of 4 or 5. If you show too much fear or sadness, someone will say something like, you know, and this is more middle school, high school, but someone will say something like, don't be a pussy, don't be a bitch, don't be a little girl. And I apologize for the swearing,
please,
but that's what we get. And so when you get that as a young boy, it hurts your feelings, you get embarrassed, and you immediately jump back in the man box and you say, well, heck, I'm not going to do that anymore. I don't like the way that feels. And then if you show too much joy, love, romanticism, excitement, someone will say something like, dude, don't be so gay. Don't be a fag. And you jump back in the man box and you go, I don't like how that feels. And so as we grow up, we learn these rules that we can only express three emotions publicly without fear of humiliation. And those are lust, stress, and some degree of anger. And so a lot of our emotions get channeled through the anger lens. That's the big one. And then there are also these rules that we kind of learn just because we're socialized this way. We pick up these rules that as men, we are supposed to not feel, be dominant, be aggressive, be invincible, be self-reliant, know everything. And those rules really hamper us later on in life when we become adults and get into a relationship because we're not socialized to communicate. We're not socialized to be emotionally aware. We're not socialized to be empathetic or supportive or listen. And so, you know, a lot of the divorces in the US, 75% are initiated by the wives. And the biggest complaint I hear is I can't connect with my husband. And it's not our fault because that's how we were socialized. But it is our responsibility, I would argue, to learn new tools so that you can shift gears in different situations. And if your wife is complaining about work, let's say, you can just listen and empathize.
And how did you get into the business of positive masculinity and anger management?
Well, you know, I was trained as a psychologist at UC Berkeley, And initially I was a school psychologist, and then I left that and did an entrepreneurial venture, pre-employment testing for about 7 years. And that burned up in the 2008 crash. So I had to reinvent myself. So I got into positive psychology. So when I was a school psychologist, I learned scientifically proven tools to kind of master that darker side, the anger, fear, sadness, guilt, shame. And then when I got into positive psychology, it was like, wow, here's tools to turn up the volume on the positive, to look for meaning and significance, to look for positive emotions and why you should care about positive emotions. And how does that fit into happiness and positive relationships and positive organizations? So then I had tools to do both, to deal with the negative and the positive. And so when I finished a radio show later, I opened up a private practice, and I wanted to focus on positive psychology. I wanted to help people go from surviving to thriving. But in 2008, there wasn't much of a market for that. So a psychiatrist friend of mine said, well, why don't you look at anger management? We could really use someone to do that in the Valley here. And I said, yeah, sure, I can do that. So I kind of combined traditional anger management with positive psychology, because my belief is that if you turn down the volume on something internally, like if you get a handle on your anger and it's less frequent and less intense and less shorter, you need something to put in its place. Otherwise, the anger can come back because there's sort of a psychological vacuum there. And my argument is that what you put there is positive thoughts, positive emotions. And you kind of change your worldview so that anger is less likely to come back. And, you know, anger will always be there. We're never going to get rid of it, but to make it less frequent. And so the anger management became a piece of what I was doing. And then I created an online course for anger management. And then things kind of blew up.
So what you're saying is there are two ways to handle anger. One, for instance, if somebody is having too much anger, it's from taking our emotions from negative to positive. And second instance is somebody's fine. They are doing fine. They don't have a lot of anger, but we can elevate the positive side through positive psychology.
Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting to me because psychology traditionally for 100 years has focused on what's wrong with us. How are you broken and how can we fix that? So let's get rid of the anger. Let's get rid of the anxiety. Let's deal with the depression or the guilt or the shame. So if we get you from -5 to 0, then I'm done. I've done my job. You're surviving now. And positive psychology looks at how do we get from surviving from 0 to +5, from surviving to thriving.
This is very powerful that you just mentioned that, because psychology is always treated as something negative, something is wrong with us. And if something is wrong with us, then there comes a resistance in human beings. Then we don't want to take any action.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes difficult for us to see that negative side. And when we know that we are at 0, that means it's okay. We have all these things, what we are going through, but through positive psychology, we can move to the positive side through different tools and practices.
Correct. And a lot of these are practices. The tools that I teach, I would argue, are practices that are lifelong, that they're things that you continue to do. You just kind of build them into your repertoire so that they become unconscious habits. And the end goal being that you experience 3 times as much positive emotion as negative emotion, which is one of the hallmarks or the lines in the sand for a happy, thriving life.
And what are the, can you please elaborate on those anger management tools from surviving to thriving?
Sure. I think that, you know, the first thing I do is I'll give my clients a framework to overlay on their mind to ask, where is your mind trying to take you right now? And if you imagine past, present, future, and then add a positive and negative to that. So now you've got positive past, positive present, positive future, and then negative past, negative present, negative future. So a lot of times when my clients come in, they're spending a lot of time in the negative past, negative present, or negative future, which leads to more misery. It could be more anger, could be more depression, could be more anxiety and stress, depending on where you are on that chart. And so I'm trying to get them to be more aware of their internal processes, thoughts, emotions, and where is your attention being placed? So that the more attentional control you gain, the more you can move from any of the negative past, negative present, negative future to where do you want to be? Positive past, positive present, positive future. So that's kind of the first step, is creating more awareness and teaching a skill like mindfulness so that you even begin to become aware of what's going on internally. Because I think a lot of us go through life on autopilot, almost like automatons. where we're mindless. You know, have you ever been driving on the freeway and you go past the exit to your house and you're like, what? Like, how did that happen?
All the time. It happens all the time.
And that's because you're not in the car with yourself when you're driving. Your mind has taken you someplace else. So you're in like a negative future worrying about maybe the presentation at business, at work tomorrow. And so that's an example of where you just aren't with yourself. Or, you know, people, you know, you take a shower and you're not in the shower with yourself when you're showering because you're worrying about what you're going to do at work today. And so, you know, mindfulness is a practice to continually bring you back to the present moment. And one of the benefits it offers is increased attentional control, which means that you can now tell your mind where you want it to go and spend more time in the positive past, positive present, positive future. So the next place I go with that is to look at anger on three different axes or spectrums. So the way I remember it is the acronym DIF. So I ask the question to myself, what's the DIF, D-I-F, where D stands for duration. How long does the anger typically last? The I is intensity. And intensity is how we normally think of anger on a 1 to 10 scale, you know, from calm to Incredible Hulk enraged. And I would say on that intensity scale, one of the keys is getting to your anger before you get to a 5 on that scale. Because if you get past a 5 on that intensity scale, to an extent, to a large extent, you become anger.
5 out of 10.
And the rational mind is gone. Sorry?
5 out of 10.
Yeah. And so you want to get to it when you're a little bit annoyed, kind of frustrated, a little bit irritated, and learn to speak up when you sense that. Hey, you know what? I need you to bring your volume down just a little bit. Or I need you to speak to me with respect. Or it makes me uncomfortable when you're doing that. So if you can speak up assertively and calmly when you're a little bit annoyed or irritated, that is a huge win. So that's the I. The F is frequency. So how often are you losing your temper? Is it once a month, once a week, once a day, once an hour? And improvement on any of those scales is improvement. But, you know, it's funny, I've had a lot of people through the years come to me for anger management help, and pretty much every one of them says, I don't know, I don't have an anger problem. And I think it's true. Anger's funny in the dynamic that when I get really angry, I will externalize all blame. So if you and I are in an argument and I'm angry, it becomes all your fault in my mind. So there's no need for me to look at myself and look at my anger and see what I can do to improve there, because I don't have any of the blame.
And this is a default response that we human beings have, to blame another person. So we have this framework called DIF, duration, intensity. And what is F again?
Frequency.
Frequency. So it is creating an awareness before we take any action.
Mm-hmm.
And that action can have any sort of mindfulness practice. So what kind of mindfulness practices, or any sort of practice, it can be mindfulness or any practice that you suggest to your clients?
Well, you know, I tend to give them a number of tools, because a lot of this, I would argue, is about stress reduction or stress management, that we're dealing with so much in this day and age. There's so many things trying to pull at our attention. There's so many demands made on us at work and at home with kids, that oftentimes stress management is a huge part of this. So just learning to relax, whether it's mindfulness or progressive muscle relaxation or loving kindness meditation, those are huge tools. And the reason, here's the reason. So in the body, we have the autonomic nervous system. And it's the bundle of nerves that comes from the brain down the spine and connects with every organ in the body. The autonomic nervous system splits into two parts, the sympathetic nervous system and the parasympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nervous system is the stress response. That's the fight, flight, freeze response. The parasympathetic is the relaxation response. It's the rest and digest response. And everyone that I've ever met is really good at hitting the button on that sympathetic nervous, that stress response, the fight, flight, freeze. And in fact, many of us men, I would argue, are socialized to be in that state very, very often. We're always vigilant. Some of us are hypervigilant. Like, I've worked with police that they have to sit at the at the chair facing the door so they can always see who's coming in the restaurant. And so with this hypervigilance, that means that we're always in this fight, flight, freeze response. So one of the big keys is to learn how to let go of that response and relax.
And I would like to ask you, how do you manage anger in your personal life if you get angry at any point?
You know, the first thing I do is breathe deeply. And it's funny, you know, when I first started this work, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, my kids were young and they would do something that would annoy me or irritate me. And I would, you know, I'd take a deep breath, focusing on the exhale out longer than I inhaled in. And I'd add a visualization to it, and I visualize white light coming in through my nose as I breathed in. And that white light can contain whatever you need: relaxation, peace, love, inclusiveness. And when I breathe out, I imagine breathing out black smoke. And in that black smoke is whatever is not serving me: stress, anger, irritation, sadness. And it was funny because it works, because it activates the parasympathetic nervous system and it calms you down, brings your heart rate down, relaxes your muscles, slows your thinking, or you're over-focusing on angry things. But my kids picked up on it at a young age. And so I would breathe deeply and they'll go, "Dad, are you irritated right now?" Well, I wasn't, but I'm getting more. You know, because it's funny, even if you ask someone, "Are you angry?" There's no good response to someone that's angry. If you say, "Breathe, relax, chill out, take a deep breath," like, all those things tend to make angry people angrier. So to me, my plea to people that are dealing with anger is, your anger is your responsibility, that you have to learn tools and you have to learn to manage it from the inside out, because there's nothing anyone can say to you when you're really pissed off that's going to help.
And if somebody is feeling angry or having any negative emotion, instead of asking that person, "Are you angry or are you pissed off?" So first of all, this is not a good question, I think. We should ask them, "How are you feeling in this moment?"
Yes.
If we ask somebody, "Are you angry?" I think it we become defensive. We try to defend ourselves. And
because they're already defensive in their anger and they're already externalizing blame. You know, if you would just stop doing this, I wouldn't be so mad.
And for me, I have one trigger that I'm keenly aware of these days. If somebody calls me self-centered, my defensive mechanism comes automatic. I try to prove myself.
Yeah, and it's funny. I mean, I've gotten one like that throughout the years. I've been told a few times that I'm arrogant. And that's an interesting one to me because, you know, to me, it's more, I was socially anxious. So I was just scared to interact with people. I was anxious. I was nervous. So I wasn't that outgoing. And it came across to others as arrogant. And it's funny because I don't think arrogance is actually a label you can apply to someone else. It seems to me that arrogance almost has to be a label you apply to yourself, but the arrogant people wouldn't do that. But, you know, to me, arrogance is when I feel superior or awesome or amazing, and all the people around me are less than me. Confidence is when I feel amazing and everyone else around me has an equal opportunity to be just as amazing. So it's putting people on the same level.
There is a fine line between confidence and being arrogant. It's like having confidence or having self-love versus narcissism.
Yeah.
And how does confidence in men relate to masculinity, or I should say positive masculinity or toxic masculinity? Because we men are being told to behave in a certain way. Don't be a girl. Don't behave like this. Don't be vulnerable. Don't show your emotions.
Yeah, it's a really good question. How does confidence relate to, well, for one, I don't like the term toxic masculinity, and I never use it. I used it once, and then I was like, "Oh, that was a mistake. I can't do that anymore." Because toxic masculinity instantly puts men on the defensive. It makes them feel like they've done something wrong. And we haven't done anything wrong. We've just been socialized in a certain way. So it's more about the culture and how we are taught to be men and what is modeled for us. So, you know, positive masculinity, I'm looking at what is the ideal of masculinity. That was kind of what started me on this. And actually, what started me was I started working with executives, and I realized that they were doing great at work and they were making ridiculous sums of money. And the biggest pain point in their lives was going home. And they would argue and bicker with their wife. I mean, usually the wife was upset because of a lack of attention, lack of time from their husband. The kids were, who are teenagers now, were angry at their dad because he was a workaholic. And so this value that we get drilled into us as young boys of be a provider, the man is the provider for the family, is actually a pretty good value. Like, I'm comfortable with that. But over 10, 20, 30 years, the value gets warped, and our own competitiveness and need to achieve and have our ego stroked gets us climbing the corporate ladder and getting paid more and more, but it also demands more and more of our time. So the very value that we start out with, which is a good value, provide for the family, gets warped and cancerous, and that same value begins to undermine the value of family.
And it comes down to work-life balance. And this is a very profound thing to understand, that we men are providers according to the society, but we get to find that sweet spot where we have to find that balance in our family as well. So how do you advise, or what advice do you have for men or women to have that work-life balance? Because we get into that rut to make more money, to be more successful, to go up in the ladder.
Well, one of the things that I do is I have clients look at values. What are your values? And that question, I think it's a great and a terrible question at the same time, because if I just ask you, Nishant, what are your values? That's really open-ended. It's very vague and abstract, and it's hard to answer. So then I tried giving people a list of values and said, okay, pick from these values. What are your top three values? And ideally, you would use those top two or three values to guide you when you're getting emotional. So for instance, your wife's yelling at you and you have the urge to yell back, the natural urge. And if you can access the value of family, is this in the best interest of my family? And the answer is no, then you can use that to calm down and perhaps avoid the argument. But what I found is we need some way to connect emotionally with our values, like really connect. And so one of the exercises I came up with was this. So imagine yourself, you're going into the ER, something really horrible is wrong with you. They rush you into the operating room. You're lying on the operating room table and your heart stops. You flatline and your soul leaves your body. And you, I would argue, are your soul. So now you're on the ceiling of the operating room looking down on your own body. And here's the question. For what would you choose to come back to live the rest of your life? For what would you choose to come rushing back into your body with purpose and passion and energy and excitement? For what would you decide to live? And the answer to that is your deepest values. And it could be, you know, wealth creation. It could be family. It could be serving others. It could be physical health. I mean, there's a number of possible answers to that, and there's no right answer, but you need to know what your driving force is, what your values are.
Do our values evolve and change with time, or they are okay? If they
definitely change, they can change every few years,
but they have to be aligned with our vision and mission.
And you asked about confidence earlier. I would say that's the foundation of integrity, which is then the foundation of confidence. Because integrity is doing what you say, saying what you do. And if what you say and do is in alignment with your values consistently, people know that you're predictable and they begin to trust you. And as they trust you, your confidence in yourself and others grows.
I would like to ask you that if somebody is having heated conversation with their family members or anybody, and they have designed some values in their life, how can they remind themselves to be in alignment with those values? Because we forget.
Yes.
Sometimes.
And we need access to those values. So there's, you know, Viktor Frankl had a great quote, and it says, it goes something like this. There is a place between stimulus and response, and within that space lies peacefulness. And that space we found in neuroscience is about a third of a second between when someone's trying to trigger you, when someone's coming at you, yelling at you, and your emotional response, your emotional mind takes over. So you've got a third of a second. So you need to be able to access those values, one or two top values, in that third of a second. Now, the good news is with practice, with something like mindfulness, with teaching, you can expand that third of a second to a second, to 5 seconds, to 10 seconds. And then you have more time to think rationally about how you want to respond.
There are two kinds of brain. One is emotional brain and second is analytical brain. Mm-hmm. And our emotional brain takes over in that flight freeze response.
Yes.
So to get into that space, and that's when meditation comes into role. When we practice meditation consistently, we can increase that space mm-hmm. or gap. But in that instance, in that real-time experience, we cannot meditate for sure. Mm-hmm. So we can, like you suggested, that we can breathe. You know, we don't have to be obnoxious breather in front of somebody. We can just internally breathe. And I practice that a lot of times in some heated conversation. Or first of all, not if we are getting into heated conversation most of the time, then there is something wrong. We get to work on our communication skills. What do you think about that?
Absolutely. I think, you know, no one ever teaches us communication skills. No one ever teaches us nonviolent communication. No one ever teaches us how to be in a relationship. I mean, my belief is that love is not enough, that we need to learn skills and tools to make us better in relationship.
And this is very practical advice, because in all those spiritual texts, we read that love cancels all the negative energy, and that's mm-hmm. true, but we need practices. You know?
Yeah, and what I see happen in couples, like if you think of us as having, you know, one bucket of positive emotions and one bucket of negative emotions, which has been shown in research that we have those positive emotions are separate from negative emotions. And why is that a big deal? Well, it's a big deal because you could be empty in your bucket of negative emotions, which would be great. And you could also be empty in your bucket of positive emotions, which is not what we're shooting for. So we want to be aware of both. But in the realm of relationship, what happens is that we get these little tiny drops of irritation, annoyance, resentment, hurt, and over time they build and that bucket gets full. And as that bucket gets filled more and more, your perception of your partner changes. And it's insidious because it's slow and you don't even realize it's happening. But when you first got together with this person, everything they did was interpreted through a positive lens. They couldn't do any wrong. And over time, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, that bucket fills and your perception grows and changes from a positive one to a negative one. And depending on how bad it gets, nothing you do can be good enough to break through that negative lens. I saw one couple once where the husband brought home flowers to the wife, and the wife's negative lens was so strong, she said, "Why did you waste money on flowers? Those are just going to die."
That happened to me long time ago with my ex-girlfriend. Same story.
So we have to be aware of those perceptions, and you can change them with awareness. That's just a decision.
So Dr. John, I would like to ask you, this is amazing conversation. I'm loving it.
So
we can be aware of our positive and negative emotions. You know, let's say I'm aware of my negative emotion bucket. I'm aware of my positive emotion bucket. I can be responsible for that. But what can we do if another person in that partnership is not willing to take considerable action?
Yeah, and that's always the big question, right? How do you get your partner to be willing to grow with you? And it's funny, I was doing an interview in San Francisco and there was an intern there and she had just graduated from Harvard. And she pulled me aside afterwards and she said, "So can I ask a question of you?" "Sure." And she said, "I just broke up with my boyfriend and I got out of a relationship 3 or 4 months ago and I'm ready to start dating again. Is there any advice you can give me on what to look for a potential relationship, for a partner?" And I thought about it and I said, "Yeah, I think that the single most important thing to look for in a partner is a growth mindset. If you can find someone that is willing to grow with you through thick and thin, then you're really onto something." Because I think a lot of times I see, and it seems to be the women that are more into personal development and growth, and the men are kind of like, "Hey, you know, love me as I am." And what happens is the wife continues to grow, but they grow apart from the husband, and the husband's content to just, you know, sit there and drink beer and watch football. And ultimately it can end up in divorce. And there if is, they just grow a little bit, it would help out a lot.
And there is another side to this. If a man is into growth mindset, that man can be considered as an arrogant man.
Do you think so?
Sometimes, I think. If
I guess
another
it depends
person,
how he shares or how he presents himself.
That is another side, yeah. So coming back to...
Okay, so yeah, so, coming back to the question. So what do you do? I think, you know, one possibility is to label the emotion for the other person. You know, honey, it looks like you're getting a little bit irritated. And I would always understate anger. So I tell all the male clients that I work with, if you're getting pissed, I want you to, if you're going to verbalize that to your wife, play down the intensity. Honey, I'm getting a little bit annoyed. I'm getting a little bit frustrated right now. Can we talk about this later? Because men's anger is scary. But, you know, one of the things you can do is help people, like, especially with your children, to label the emotion that you see on them. Gee, it looks like you're a little bit sad right now, or it looks like you're getting a little bit frustrated. That's one thing you can do. The other thing to do, I get this question from women a lot. What do I do with my husband who is angry? And the one thing you can do, I've done some work with Jed Diamond, who's, you know, to me a legend in this field. And he wrote a book called The Irritable Male Syndrome. And so you could, as the wife, read that book when you're together and just be like, oh, that's interesting. And, you know, you could ask him to take the quiz in the book, or you can just leave the book around in the hopes that he picks it up. But it's a difficult question, particularly around anger, because not many people want to admit that they have a problem with anger. And yet I think all of us do. If anyone has ever mentioned your anger's out of control, that's a big red flag. If anyone says, you know, you might want to look at that, you should look at that. I mean, when I was going through the end of my marriage, my wife at the time said, you've got an anger problem. And at first, my response was, screw you. Then it was like, I suck. And then it was like, wait, what? And I think that's often the case. You know, you externalize the anger, you internalize the anger. And then if you can get past those two phases, you can honestly look at the feedback. And so what I did is I started practicing these tools and gathering these tools to really look at my own anger. Everyone needs to do that.
Sorry to interrupt you. Did you ever ask your wife that, what kind of anger? How does your anger show up?
Well, at the time it would show up with us raising our voices with each other. And when we get in arguments, we would escalate. And so then I started working on ways to stay calm, even when she was yelling at me for something that, like, I knew she was yelling at me and I didn't do anything wrong. So that was kind of a turning point. As soon as I got to that point, I was like, it becomes really obvious who has the anger issue when someone's yelling at the other person and one person can stay calm. And so, you know, when this was happening, I would just, you can split your attention. So part of my attention was on my wife, now my ex-wife, and I would listen to her and respond appropriately. Yes, I hear what you're saying. I get it. The other part of my attention was in my head, coaching me to stay calm. Just breathe. This has nothing to do with you. This is her stuff. It's not about you. And I had a line from the Shins, one of their songs. It was, you can't wrestle a dove. And so I was just repeating these things in my head and breathing deeply. And I found I could stay calm even when she was escalating in anger.
That is interesting. Very interesting, actually. And coming back to two buckets of emotions. One is negative and second is positive. So you mentioned that when our negative emotions, our negative bucket gets full, we operate from anger. So one option is not to fill that bucket and be aware of all those emotions and doing things to stop filling that bucket.
Mm-hmm.
What can we do about it? Because when we are in a relationship, our emotional high is so high.
Yes.
And we are just thinking about the positive side. We don't see those flaws in another person. And if someone else can see those flaws, but we cannot see that.
Right.
And that hurt, anger, resentment takes years to build up.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of building up, and if we do something about it, and if we are aware of it, we can stop.
Well, there's a lot of things that can be done. One of the things is you look at the metaphors you're using around anger. So, you know, when I talk about those buckets of negative and positive emotions, that's a bad metaphor, but it's what I remember starting out with. When I was a kid, I just thought, well, if I can suppress this anger and contain it, I'll be fine. But emotions get too powerful at a point and they erupt. So I think that bucket metaphor is good to start with. But then the next step is to drill holes in the bucket of negative emotions. The next step is to look at that bucket of negative emotions, not as a bucket, but as a colander or a strainer, where you dump the hot water and the pasta in the strainer, all the hot water goes through, the pasta stays there. So the pasta is the good stuff, the positive stuff. The hot water is the bad stuff that you want to let go of, because emotions are not meant to stay with us. They're merely messengers, and they should stay for, you know, seconds. But then I realized in my work, I get a lot of negative emotions from clients at times. So I needed an even better metaphor. So now I think of myself as a big fishing net with big gaping holes stretched across a river. And the river's all that emotion coming at me every day, but it just passes through me quickly on a split second level. And the net holds on to anything good that's in the water, compliments, kind deeds, good thoughts. So the metaphor is a big deal, the metaphors that you use. The other part is to be aware of where your perception is of your partner. You know, how negative is it? How positive is it? And one of the ways to make it more positive is to actively practice gratitude and appreciation, and to play a game with your partner of just spotting everything they do that's helpful to you and to the relationship and to the household. Gee, honey, thank you so much for emptying the dishwasher. I really appreciate that. Thank you for taking out the garbage. That is so nice. I love it when you touch me. Can you sit next to me? You smell beautiful today. You know, and so you practice kind of looking for different things to appreciate about your partner. And, you know, one of the things I did with my fiance is we even played a game of putting post-it notes up on the bathroom mirror. But you've got to try and come up with different things each time, because you can't just say, I love you 46 times on the mirror. You want to come up with different things, right?
Be creative.
You're training your mind to look for the good rather than looking for the bad.
Is it like a love language?
It's a good question. I think, you know, the love languages, that's a great book, The Five Love Languages. Yeah, I think they're words of affirmation. So yes, I would put that into one of the love languages.
And everyone has different love languages.
Right.
And we get to be aware and ask our partner what their love language is.
You should be aware of the top two so you can speak to them.
And I hear this thing most of the time. People say that they are not sure. They like everything.
So yeah, what are the five love languages? We've got quality time. We've got words of affirmation. We've got small gifts. We've got acts of service.
Physical touch.
And touch. And yeah, so if you just know the top two, because I think a lot of men do acts of service. You know, they'll go and wash the car, take out the trash, empty the dishwasher. And to them, that's showing love. And it is. It's caring. Those are caring acts. And if your spouse or partner's love language is not acts of service, which often it's not, then you're missing. So you want to know, you know, what do you like? Do you like physical touch? Do you like words of affirmation? And then exploit that. Use it. I mean, you know, if they want words of affirmation, send them the little memes that say, I love you in different ways. Tell them you can't wait to see them when you get home. Talk about how sexy they looked in that skirt going to work. Tell them how much you want them. And so, you know, it's with anger, it's always how do you turn down the anger and how do you turn up the volume on the positive, in my opinion.
Do you recommend any book in positive psychology for our listeners to control their anger if they have?
I mean, Authentic Happiness is a great one by Martin Seligman. And it's not specific to anger, but, you know, I do think that the more we can train our mind to look for what's going right, to look for things around us to appreciate and be grateful for, gratitude is a huge one. I mean, just going outside and looking at what you have to be grateful for, fresh air, trees, rainbows. I mean, how amazing is it that we live on a planet with oxygen we can breathe, with clouds, with rainbows, with the natural beauty around us? And then, you know, compassion is one of the antidotes to anger too. So practicing putting yourself in the other person's shoes and trying to feel what they're feeling. And also, I think, trying to uncover the intention. What is their intention? Because often the intentions are good. Maybe the execution's bad, but they're not coming out to hurt you. They're coming out because they're afraid or they're hurt or they're scared. So yeah, I would say gratitude and compassion are two of the big ones.
And speaking of the relationships again, I have this question. If we have a date or if we are, you know, if we are interacting with our partner, should we ask them, what is your intention for our communication for next 1 hour or so?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that would be a good question. It depends on the partner. But, you know, and to me, disagreements are never about the disagreement, or they're rarely about the disagreement. They're usually value conflicts over values. So let's say a husband and wife are arguing over, like the wife is angry because he's never home, which is a pretty common argument. You know, he's working too much. They can argue over that, but in truth, they're arguing over the values that are behind it. So the wife is arguing for quality time and family. Those are her top values in that argument. The husband is arguing for being a provider, the need to provide for the family. Now, there's no wrong in either one of those. Those are all good values. And so if you can pull back and look at the values involved, you can often calm yourself down a little bit and say, wait, we're on the same page here. We're both arguing for things that are just and right.
When these two persons have different values, can we negotiate?
Mm-hmm.
Values can negotiate and be aligned with both the persons?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's the point, because if you realize that you're arguing for more, for being a provider, and the wife is arguing for basically quality time, more time at home, then you can negotiate the time. How much time, like, okay, well, let me pull back on work and I'll spend more time at home.
Yeah, that is very interesting. It is going to take work, effort, and time. It's not going to happen overnight.
Yeah, and the other thing I would say about anger in relationships is once you get past a 5 on that intensity scale, stop arguing. Like, that, nothing you say is going to get in your partner's head, and nothing they say is going to get in your head. Because when I'm above a 5 on that anger scale, all I'm trying to do is get you to admit how right I am and how right my perspective is, and just say, wow, gee, John, I am so sorry. Like, you are so right. And that's never going to happen, because, you know, your partner's above a 5 too. And so nothing you say is getting into their head. And so there's no use yelling and screaming at each other. You don't get anywhere.
Then how does passive aggression come into this play?
Well, yeah, then so your bucket is filled with negative emotions. So you start saying, that bastard, like, I'm going to make him pay, in little subtle ways, and just make his life miserable. And, you know, I don't know, screw up his clothes in the wash, or, you know, and it just increases the irritation and frustration, and it fills up the negative bucket more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question is, are your actions helping to make things better, or are they making things worse?
And that's when we have to remind ourselves and have the practices in our daily lives to be consistent about it, and having meditation, gratitude practice, journaling practices.
Right. Forgiveness.
Breathing,
as a
forgiveness.
Practice.
And forgiveness is tough. It's tough. For
forgiveness is a big one, because it's one of the best ways I know of to empty out that bucket of negative emotions.
Do you face challenges from your clients that they ever say they cannot forgive, which is tough for them?
Oh, yeah. That's one of the biggest hurdles to forgiveness. No, that's unforgivable. I can never forgive that. Well, that's the confusion of an unforgivable act with an unwillingness to forgive. Because in truth, everything is actually forgivable. You may not be ready to forgive, but the crux of it is, you have to realize that the act of forgiveness is done to let go of your own anger, your old stale anger. It does not mean that you approve of what was done to you. And so once you get that you forgive to help yourself, then you can get to a point where you can forgive anything, murder, rape. And it's difficult. It's not easy, but it is one of the most worthwhile practices I know of, because you just don't want to be carrying around that old anger. It doesn't hurt the other person. I think at some level, like, let's say someone assaulted me and robbed me of my wallet, and I'm holding on to anger at that person. It doesn't do anything. My anger doesn't do anything to get back at that person. But I think there's this childish part of us, the inner 5-year-old, that's like, I'm going to make him pay. But they don't even know. They don't even care that you're angry. So your anger only serves to hurt you.
And in the process of forgiveness, I think the myth is that we have to approve of their actions. We don't have to approve. We don't
right.
have to forget. We don't have to forget their
right.
actions. We
can forgive, just, but not forget.
Yeah. This is very profound. And when we forgive, we can release those negative emotions that we are holding on to.
And that's a daily practice, right? I mean, I do this every time I put my head on my pillow to go to bed. I'll go through a list of people that annoyed me or irritated me or angered me or wronged me. And when I first started the practice, the list was pretty long. And now it's short. It gets shorter over time, because the stuff that is kind of minor just kind of falls off the list. You're like, I'm not really angry about that anymore. And the benefits from this, as shown in research studies, are huge. You know, less anger, less depression, less anxiety, more frequent positive emotions. And, you know, this research was done on parents that had lost their children. And, you know, in one case, it was in bombings in Northern Ireland. In the other case, it was gangland violence in inner cities in the U.S. But the parents forgave the murderers of their children. So, you know, to say that something is unforgivable just isn't true. It can be terrible. It can be heinous, and it's still forgivable.
Yes, indeed. And here, I would love to shift some gears from anger to happiness.
Okay.
So you are an award-winning author of the book, How Can I Be Happy?
Mm-hmm.
Who is this book for?
Initially, it was for myself. You know, I wrote it back like 2006, roughly. And I had the realization that I had a PhD in psychology from UC Berkeley, and I was still an emotional idiot. I swear to God.
This is awesome.
This was why I got into psychology, right? Like, I got into psychology because I was like, okay, I'm a smart guy, but what are these damn emotions that keep like tripping me up? And I just couldn't get a handle on them. And Berkeley was all about cognitive psych. So it was all about how we think, because studying emotions in research is hard. You know, it's hard to get everyone in the same place. Like, how do you get everyone at a zero on a happiness meter and then measure an intervention to see how much happier it made them? So it's hard to establish a baseline emotionally, but I really wanted to find out more. So I wrote it, and I always like books that simplify things. And so one of my goals has been to make things more simple and not use nomenclature or, you know, industry specific vocabulary to hide. I want to make things simple so people can use the research that has been done. So I made this book just as simple as I could. Like, here's the negative emotions that we know of. Here's the positive emotions. Here's some exercises that you can do to decrease the volume on the negative and increase the volume on the positive, because I think it's one of the biggest goals we should have in this lifetime. Because every one of the 7.5 billion people on this planet want to be happy.
Everybody
we go about
wants
it in different
happy.
Ways. You know, some people pursue wealth, some pursue fame, some pursue serving others. You know, there's different ways to go. But at the end of the day, I think we all want to be happy.
And what is happiness?
So to me, happiness has four pillars, and they all have to do with relationships. So relationship to yourself, relationship to others, relationship to work, and relationship to something bigger than yourself. So, you know, the relationship to yourself is all about learning to manage your thoughts and your emotions, your internal landscape, and, you know, experiencing less frequent negative emotions, experiencing more frequent positive emotions. And then relationships is surrounding yourself with positive, supportive people. And that takes a little bit of work and time. So it's practicing being better in relationship with a partner, but it's also surrounding yourself with more positive and supportive friends. Relationship to work is finding and discovering meaningful work, or finding meaning in the work that you're doing already and crafting that job so that it plays more to your strengths, your naturally occurring strengths. And then relationship to a higher power or something bigger than yourself. I think that can be something like the military. It can be something like the corporation, like working for a great corporation. I think it's also serving something beyond yourself, a higher power, a god of your choosing. But I think that to live purely for yourself is, I think it leaves you short at the end of the day.
And this is a great framework when we can have relationship with ourselves, with others, with a higher power, and with that bigger cause. And this is a framework that we get to work on every single day,
mm-hmm.
to increase our happiness level. And there is no limit of happiness. It's infinite.
Right. And I would say, just as a reminder to the listeners, happiness, the goal is not constant happiness. That's never going to happen. You know, you have moods, you have different emotions for a reason. So your mood is going to ebb and flow. And that's normal. So part of it is allowing whatever's arising to arise without judgment. And so if you're sad or bummed out one day, be sad and be bummed out. Like, feel it, turn towards it.
And Eastern philosophy mentions that there is no way to happiness. It already exists inside you. There is no way to acquire. It doesn't exist in the external world.
Yeah, and it's funny, because I would say you can't pursue happiness as a goal in and of itself. But what you can do is put conditions in place in your life that cultivate more frequent positive emotions and more meaning. And
yes,
that's one of the big ways to go.
Yeah. Great, Dr. John. It's been an amazing conversation. So where can our listeners find you online?
They can find my podcast at theevolvedcaveman.com. And they can find more about my coaching at guidetoself.com. And there's a shop there where right now you can get any of my online courses, anger management, anxiety management, happiness, for $19.95. I've put them on sale recently to help out with the pandemic. They're normally about $147 to $197. So you can check them out there. You can check out the book there and find out all you need.
Thank you, Dr. John. It was amazing. Thank you for your wisdom.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode today. I hope you learned from this episode that you can apply in your life. If you did enjoy this, please subscribe to the podcast, The Nishant Garg Show, on Apple Podcasts. You can also subscribe to the show through my website, https://nishantgarg.me, nishantgarg.me. You can also share this podcast with your family and friends or whoever want to feel fulfilled. And thank you so much again.